Support for The Full Story comes from Long Wharf Theater, creating theater of, for, and by the people of Greater New Haven. Everyone's story has a place at Long Wharf. You belong.
According to statistics, most of us don't have a will. Experts tell us that's primarily because most of us don't want to think about dying. And that's why today's program about possibly ending your life when you are terminally ill may be disturbing to some. Welcome, everyone, to The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak, and indeed today's show is about what happens when you get a diagnosis of a terminal illness. There are now 8 states and Washington, D.C., which have a form of what is called aid in dying laws. Backers of such legislation say those who have received a diagnosis that they have less than 6 months to live should be able to enlist the assistance of a doctor so they can end their life. Opponents say, look, this is just wrong for a number of reasons, and they're going to be joining us later in the program to give us those reasons. But the backers of the legislation in New York and Connecticut are continuing to try to get the legislation passed. And we're going to start today's program by finding out what's taking place in Connecticut. And then we'll hear a little bit later on about what's taking place in New York. Democratic State Representative Jonathan Steinberg from Westport is joining us. He's the House Chair of the Legislature's Public Health Committee. How are you, Representative? Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Good to talk with you again, Ron.
Same here. James Naughton is also with us. You know his name. You know his voice. Jim Naughton is a Connecticut resident. He's a well-known actor. He won a Tony. He's joining us today because a few years back, his wife died of pancreatic cancer. That led him to testify in support of the aid in dying legislation. Jim, nice to meet you. Welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Hello, Ron. Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Representative Steinberg, what does the legislation call for?
It is effectively the same legislation that we ran last year and what we did not get out of committee. It is modeled on what some other states have done successfully, specifically in the Pacific Northwest. We're talking about a very small subsegment of the population, people who have a terminal diagnosis of no more than 6 months to live. They are required to get not one but two physician assents, and perhaps including a psychiatric analysis if there's some concern there. There are all sorts of belts and suspenders here to make sure that people are making the decision not under duress, not under pressure from family members. And they have more than one opportunity to opt out after they begin the process. So we're talking about personal choice with regard to their quality of life, for a very small group of people, and we feel this is their choice, and it's a matter of personal freedom.
Representative, as you mentioned, you've been trying to get this legislation passed for a number of years now. Will this year, this session, be any different?
Well, it is a challenge for us. I'll admit that. The composition of our committee is identical to what it was last year, and there were a number of members in our committee who had reservations. The reason we're raising this bill again this year is that with each succeeding year, the momentum seems to increase. We have more experience and history of other states on which to draw. We have been able, therefore, to dispel some of the myths and concerns that have been raised by those who have opposed this bill about some of the consequences that have not transpired. We've also seen a shift in the position of professional societies. For example, the Connecticut Medical Society is now taking a neutral position. Some of its physicians are still concerned, but the medical society recognizes that this is something that is becoming more and more accepted, and that as long as physicians have the ability to decide for themselves whether or not to participate in this, that the medical society should not stand as an obstacle. So I think the Connecticut Medical Society is more forward-looking than some of the other organizations, but it is a sign of a slowly evolving trend to accept this limited option.
Jim, if I could add to that.
Sure, please.
Ron, and hello, Representative Steinberg. It's, I think, acknowledged that some 70 to 80% of Americans identify as religious. And yet 72% of Americans also support this legislation. And that's two-year-old statistics. The last Gallup poll was 72% of Americans supporting this legislation. I'd like to make a couple of points. One is, it's a very, very small percentage, under 1% of terminally ill people who actually use this legislation. But even if they don't use it, and I've been told this by people who are dying, that it gives them peace of mind knowing that there is an option, so that a suffering person is spared the dread that he'll have to endure unbearable pain, loss of autonomy, loss of dignity. We have a friend whom Representative Steinberg knows as well, a woman who testified last year, as did I. She spent her career as a hospice nurse and said last year that she was hoping that this legislation would be passed because she expected that she was going to need it. She has stage 4 metastatic lung cancer. I asked about how she was doing recently, and I was just told, unfortunately, that she just put her house in Connecticut on the market because she does need this help, and she's going to have to try to move at this stage of her life and in this stage of her suffering to New Jersey, which just passed this legislation last year. So that's kind of what's going on among people that we know, and it seems like a terribly tough time to have to pull up stakes and move away from your family, your neighborhood, your home, in order to get this merciful
treatment. Mr. Naughton mentioned two really important words, the dignity and suffering. And this is what we're really talking about here. People have no choice but to deal with their suffering. And I personally do not believe that that's something that they should be obliged to do because other people think that that's their obligation. There is a legitimate philosophical divide here when it comes to what some individuals' rights are versus what other people believe. And this is a personal choice. It doesn't affect anybody else. Yes, the family members are going to have to obviously deal with what is inevitable in any case. But this is the individual's decision. And if they're suffering, they should have the right to go out on their own terms, so to speak, with dignity. And a lot of what you're going to probably hear from other people, Ron, after we're done speaking, we'll talk about what they think other people should do. And we're talking about what an individual should have the right to choose for themselves.
You know, I have a friend who has just been through this, a dear friend and a wonderful actor named René Aubergenois, who was a fabulously successful actor in stage, screen, television. He was on Star Trek Deep Space Nine 10 years ago. I just got an email from his wife, Judith. She said he and our family are grateful that he lived in a state that recognizes a person's right to die with dignity. And so on a Saturday morning, after 4 years of dealing with lung cancer, he and his wife and their children were all able to be together and end his suffering. And I think rather than ending people's lives, the way we think about this is ending the suffering of someone who is at the end of his life.
Just let me tell the audience that the voice you're hearing belongs to Jim Naughton, the actor. His wife passed from pancreatic cancer a number of years ago, and we're also spending just another 2-3 minutes with Representative Jonathan Steinberg. He's up at the state capitol. They've got a lot going on there nowadays, so we only have him for another 2 or 3 minutes. And with that, Representative, let me ask you, do you think going forward, do you think your bill is going to have a greater chance of passage? Because boomers, we're part of the boomer generation. Everyone who's a boomer is getting older, and being forced to think about this, being forced to confront the end now.
Well, I remember when I was 22, I thought I'd remain 22 forever. I think that's part of the boomer ethos. But I think your point's well taken. I think more of us are confronting chronic diseases and some debilitation. It's not quite the same thing as facing life-ending disease, but quite likely we know somebody who's been in this circumstance. We have had dealt with a parent who's been in this circumstance or know of that. I think that there's more relevant experience, but I think it's a challenge for us as a committee and as a society to recognize that as much as we might like it, hospice and palliative care cannot provide adequate answers for everybody. We're very proud of our hospice care system in the state of Connecticut, and they can offer, quality care and a great environment for so many people. But we're talking about a small percentage of the population for whom that doesn't apply. It's still a challenge for our society.
Just let me squeeze in one last question before you get going, and we only have 45 seconds left. Just out of curiosity, do you know of anyone who has left the state, who has maybe left New York or Connecticut, and moved to other states where aid in dying is the law?
Yes, I know of more than one.
Okay.
And that's unfortunate. We talk a lot about people leaving the state. It's a topic in Connecticut these days. We understand the reasons why they've chosen to do so, but we much prefer that they have those options here.
Jim, do you know of anyone?
Yes, I do, and I know this woman who spent her career as a hospice nurse is in the process of doing exactly that.
She's planning to move out of Connecticut. Okay.
Yes.
All right, Representative. I know you have to get going. Thanks. I appreciate you talking to us today.
Anytime, Ron.
It's Representative Jonathan Steinberg, Connecticut State Representative, Democrat out of Westport, the co-chair of the Public Health Committee. Jim Naughton is nice enough to stick with us for a few more minutes. We'll be catching up more with him right after the break. Jim, I read your testimony, and there was one part where you were very honest, and you basically said that you were, when your wife turned to you and basically said, enough is enough, you were conflicted, weren't you?
Well, what she said to me actually was, I don't want to wake up anymore. And when your wife says, after you've been dealing with this disease for 4 years, heroically, in her case, when she finally got there, she looked at me and she said, Jimmy, you know, we've always known that this was a fatal disease. And when she said to me, I don't want to wake up anymore, I knew then that there was nothing that I wouldn't have done to help her. And that's the position, because I've been there. That's the position that the loved ones of people who are dying and suffering find themselves in. And 9 states, by the way, not 8, have passed this, and the District of Columbia. And we know it's going to happen some more, and momentum is moving in this direction. 72% of Americans want it to happen. And it's just terribly difficult when you know someone who's suffering like that and doesn't have the option because they don't happen to live in the right state. I think it's the merciful thing to do, and I think for those of us who've been through it and who understand what that means, it's incumbent upon us to try to get it done, try to convince people that it's important. One of the things I'd like to point out is people with disabilities have said that they have they're afraid that people with disability might be put in a position where people who could benefit from their death, heirs, for example, family members, could put pressure on them to take their lives. Oregon passed this legislation in 1997, and for 22 or 23 years, at the end of every year, they have to submit a report, if there had been such an instance. And in all that time, there has not been one. So that argument, I think, while I understand it, I don't think it's borne out by what we've seen. It would be a felony, for example, for someone to do something like that. But in the case of Oregon, 22, 23 years, there has not been one documented case of that.
Hmm.
So I think that the argument is one that is an emotional argument, but it's not borne out by any of the evidence.
But Jim, those who are opposed have also said that this legislation puts doctors in a horrible position, and for some it puts them on a slippery slope, because what if a patient comes to a doctor and says, look, I feel okay now, but I'm listening to what everyone is telling me, and I know I only have a limited time left, and I don't want to be a burden on anyone. I don't want to suffer. What about the effect on the doctors?
Well, obviously, doctors don't have to do it. What the legislation calls for is that there are doctors who would love to help people out of their misery, And there are other doctors for whom, for whatever reason, might be personal, might be religious, they don't want to participate in that, and they certainly have every right to that. So I don't think that that's necessarily a problem.
Jim, if you don't mind, I want to bring in someone who has been in I think, a similar position to what you unfortunately have had to go through. Eve Elliott is joining us. Eve is from Long Island, and she is one of the leaders of New York's Aid in Dying movement. Hi, Eve. How are you?
Hi. I'm feeling really happy for this opportunity. Thank you.
I'm glad you're on with us today, and I appreciate your time. And please meet Jim Naughton.
So, hello, Eve.
Hi.
So Eve, tell us about your husband.
Well, my husband began to have his symptoms of neurologic decline in June of 2012. And as the months went on, no matter how much physical therapy he was getting, because we thought it might be an L4 thing, no matter how many antibiotics infusions he was getting intravenously, because we thought it might be infectious, and based on Lyme's disease, his decline continued until finally in December of 2012, he was diagnosed with ALS. And at that point, he was a professional artist. He was one of the rare people that made his living painting and selling paintings, and also enjoyed baking bread every single day, and enjoyed fishing and making fishing lures and inventing things. So his whole life was about his hands. And also his ability to ambulate and sail his boat and catch fish and everything. So when in the early spring of 2013, it seemed absolutely impossible for him to want to live anymore. I thought he might die of boredom, actually, if nothing else. And when people would call, I'm laughing because he was so funny up until the end. And when people would call him and say, how you doing? Because they knew the diagnosis was hopeless and terminal. He would say, things are declining faster than I can lower my standards. Because every couple, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Every couple of days, more and more capacities would go away. After the ankle brace failed, and then the walker failed, and then he was in the wheelchair, it was unbearable. And in the morning, he would wake up and look at me and say, other people wake up from nightmares, and we wake up into a nightmare.
Hmm. So, here's the only thing. I'm tight on time, so I'm going to ask you, what did your husband do?
Okay, so what he did was, he started looking around, because he had once had a pistol and a shotgun to shoot sharks with after he had caught them and had gotten rid of these guns. He started researching online how to do himself in. And I, of course, had read Final Exit, and there was no way I was getting pills because I tried. Finally, a friend of ours, quite by accident, mentioned Compassion and Choices. And that very day we got online, and there happened to be an NPR interview with the then chief of the organization. And at the end of the interview, after we heard the options that she mentioned, we called the number that was on the NPR screen. And sure enough, she herself picked up. And we said, oh, my God, we feel like we're talking to a star here. And we explained our perturbation. And she said that she would assign us Pamela Edgar, who then spent a lot of time on the phone with us and sent us the booklet. And Jim chose Voluntary Stopping Eating and Drinking. And on a Saturday morning in May of 2013, he did not have his coffee. He did not have any food or drink. And that Friday morning at 1 a.m., May 24th, 2013, 51 weeks into the illness, before any tubes were necessary, which was part of the reason he was leaving, he stopped breathing. And I was saying to Patty earlier today, it was like Compassion and Choices saved our lives.
Eve Elliott is sharing her saga with us. Jim Naughton is still with us. Jim, I'm going to ask you to hold on the line for just one more second, because sure, I do want to bring in someone from Compassion and Choices New York, and that's Corinne Carey. Hi, Corinne. How are you? Nice to meet you.
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
So from what I understand from my readings, you helped to get this legislation passed in New Jersey, didn't you?
I did. I led the campaign in New Jersey with folks like Jim and Eve advocating on behalf of the loved ones that they have lost. And we made the case to lawmakers, and they approved the law just about a year ago in March, and it went into effect in August.
Now you're trying for the same in New York?
Yes, we are.
And what response are you getting from the legislators?
We are making progress every single day. You know, it's very difficult to talk about death and dying. I'm sure your listeners can hear the heaviness in some of these stories. And it's the same with lawmakers. Look, all of us are invested in making sure that our loved ones don't suffer at the end of life. And that's what this is about. But breaking through the barriers of fear about death and dying is a big job. And that's what we did over 7 years of a campaign in New Jersey. I know that's what our advocates are doing on the ground in Connecticut, and we're doing the same here in New York. Support is growing, support within the medical community. The majority of our doctors in New York have responded that they think that the Medical Aid in Dying Act is a responsible piece of legislation that allows them to care for their patients up until the very end with this compassionate option. Support among people living with disabilities is growing, and I think that lawmakers can't ignore that any longer.
Jim, you're in your mid 70s, aren't you?
Yes.
Friends your age, as Corinne said, this is a difficult topic. It's not exactly something where people sit around having a few cocktails and say, "Hey, let's talk about dying." But do you have a group of friends who are saying, "You know, we need to talk about this and prepare"?
Well, you know, it's a subject that has been getting a lot of attention lately, and I just don't meet people who don't say, "Oh, this is something we have got to get done." I mean, all the people I know, if I'm out with folks and this subject comes up, I mean, to a man or a woman, they're for it. As I said before, and I'll say it again, 72% of Americans supported this in 2018. And I know that the momentum is going in this direction, so it's more than that now.
But then why is it having such a rough time in Connecticut and New York? How come it's not getting passed?
Well, there are a couple of constituencies that pour a lot of money into the other side. One of them is the religious community. But that's the reason we're on the phone, and that's the reason that we're trying to raise the consciousness of folks about this. Because it's terribly important. I have a friend who used to live in Connecticut. He moved to Florida. He wants his daughter to take him to Switzerland because he thinks he can go to Switzerland and have this kind of assistance there because they don't have it in Florida and they don't have it in Connecticut. His daughter doesn't want to do it, but she said if that's what he wants, she'll take him to Switzerland.
Corinne, I know you've heard all the arguments, and I just have to ask you for the main one before our next guests come on in the next segment who are opposed to the aid in dying legislation. What about those who basically said, look, this is immoral. Every life is sacred. It's not up to us. It's not our decision.
So I spent the day in Albany with a pastor. Actually, a doctor one day, a pastor the next day. And it's easy for lawmakers to hear those arguments and to do nothing. It's much easier to do nothing than to be courageous and do something. The fact is, when this bill becomes law in New York, when it becomes law in Connecticut, which it inevitably will, nothing changes for those who believe that their relationship with their creator, their relationship with God, means that they can't do this. No one who feels that way would ever request medical aid in dying. No doctor is obligated to participate. No pharmacist is obligated to participate. And no patient, obviously, is required to ask for this. This is patient-directed. And when these laws pass, nothing changes for people who oppose it. However, as long as lawmakers continue to think about it, to deliberate about it, to vacillate, to sort of be afraid to come out and pass these laws, more and more people suffer. The body count grows every single year of people like Eve's husband and Richard's wife who suffer tremendously. And lawmakers today have the power in Connecticut and New York to make sure that that no longer happens, that for those people for whom even the best palliative care, even the best hospice is not enough to relieve their suffering, lawmakers have the power to change that for those people right now.
Eve, before I forget, I want to say thank you for sharing with us, because even all these years later, I'm sure there must be some pain involved with it. So thank you for that. Can I ask you, if the aid in dying legislation had passed before your husband got sick, what would he have done differently?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
If the legislation was law in New York, when your husband got sick, did you discuss what he would have done differently? I know that he didn't take any food or drink for 6 days. Would he have gone to a doctor and requested medication?
I think so, even though he was a do-it-yourself kind of guy. And we were looking at various poisonous plants in my perennial garden that are known to be extremely fatal. I think that at first he certainly would have consulted a doctor, absolutely.
Do you have...
Sometimes trying something like this, you know, they say don't try this at home on your own. Sometimes trying to do that without supervision can be extremely backfiring. And we had some good laughs about using aconite for killing him. But yes, definitely we would have consulted doctors. We had integrative helpers. We had a wonderful team. Definitely.
Corinne, Jim, I'm just about out of time. I have about a minute left for each of you for final thoughts. Corinne, if you don't mind, I'd like to start with you.
Sure. I think Eve raises a really important point. The alternative is horrifying. We are leaving people with the only answer being looking for ways to take their own lives. And these are traumatic events. People stockpile medication. They look for medicinals that they believe, you know, we're in the midst of an overdose crisis all across the country. It seems quite easy to overdose. Well, for someone who has been on pain medication for years, it isn't quite that easy. And people end up in a coma. They end up in life support and dying in ways that they never wanted. Even worse than that is people who take matters into their own hands with a firearm. And these suicides reverberate through communities and through families for generations. These are the kind of things that we're trying to prevent. And in giving people a safe, above board option that's approved by the legislature to have a peaceful death with the assistance of medical aid in dying. The alternatives are just unacceptable.
Jim, I only have about 30 seconds left.
Yes.
For final thoughts, please.
Well, we're certainly not trying to get legislation passed to mandate the use of anything. What we're trying to do is make it possible for the people, the very small percentage of people who are suffering at the end of their lives, and trying to allow them some kind of merciful way to go out. And that's in the hands of the of our state reps and legislators. And if you believe in this, and if you're listening to this radio show, please call your rep, your state representative or state senator, and say this is important. We want to get this done for those folks who need it.
Actor Jim Naughton, Corinne Carey, director of Compassion and Choices New York, and Eve Elliott, Long Island native, a leader in New York's aid in dying movement. Thank you all.
Thank you, Ron.
John Kelly is going to be joining us. He is the New England director of the group called, known as Not Dead Yet. John is from Massachusetts. And John, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ron.
To be frank, I thought your group originally was called Second Thoughts. Has that changed or...?
No, Second Thoughts Massachusetts is the state affiliate of Not Dead Yet, and we work in Massachusetts against assisted suicide, and we have a sister group in Connecticut, Second Thoughts Connecticut, and you've spoken with Kathy Ludlam, one of the leaders of that group. But for this show, I'm putting on my Not Dead Yet regional director hat, because this impacts New England and New York is where Not Dead Yet is located.
I know this is an incredibly serious program that we have today, and still I hear Not Dead Yet, and I'm thinking of Monty Python, right?
Well, that is where it comes from.
Oh, it does come from there. Okay.
Yeah.
So it comes from Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
It comes from the scene where the young man brings out his father, and the father says, "But I'm not dead yet."
Exactly.
And
bring out your dead.
Bonks him on the head.
Do me a favor. Anyway, John, it's good to have you on the program. Why are you opposed to the Aid in Dying legislation?
I'm opposed because it puts in danger people who are not dying, people who may be being abused. You know, hospice data shows us that 12 to 15% of people admitted to hospice are not dying. They have their six-month terminal diagnosis, but they're actually not dying. Doctors admit that they cannot predict when people will die. And so the proponents, as well-intentioned as they are, they say it's for a very small group of people. It is, but that small group of people is putting everyone in danger because everyone is at risk of a misdiagnosis. J.J. Hansen, a New York former government official, was given 4 months to live and told there was nothing that could be done. He got a second opinion. He got surgery. He ended up living for 3 more years. And, you know, just giving the lie to this terminal diagnosis that people are in the actual act of dying.
Hmm. So, John, I was reading about, I was on your website last night. And I was reading about that one particular argument that you're making now. And you're saying, look, doctors sometimes can get it wrong for a variety of reasons. They don't obviously want to get it wrong, but sometimes you're just not 100% right. But what if someone, and I was thinking about this, what if someone is weeks away and they know the end is very close? What about then? So what if you reduce the time from 6 months to, let's say, a month? Would you be okay with that?
No, I wouldn't, because even at that point, people may live much longer. Many doctors have stories. And if this is about palliative care, you know, we should talk about that. That, you know, good palliative care doctors can prevent people from experiencing pain. But what these bills are about, and Jim Naughton brought these up, that it was about the dread, the loss of autonomy, loss of dignity. These are disability issues. When people who become like us, seriously disabled, severely disabled people, and want to die, it is no place for the state to take their side and say that everyone has to be put at risk in order for these people to have a state-sanctioned suicide.
So you're saying the states, communities, the states, the federal government should put more money, more funding into end-of-life care, which you think would just end this whole discussion?
Well, it should, but it will not end the discussion because, as proponents will admit, it's not really about pain. It's about control. It's a feeling embarrassed by loss of dignity. The New Hampshire bill, for example, talks about embarrassing indignities. And we disabled people who depend on other people for our personal care refuse to go along with a program that says that needing care from another person is undignified and might be to assist in our death. And, you know, some legislators come out against this because it means that the state is at cross purposes with itself. The state cannot be doing suicide prevention for some and suicide promotion for others. And it is assisted suicide, as the American Medical Association, American College of Physicians, both have come out against it and insisted on the realistic language.
If you're just joining us, John Kelly is with us from the group Not Dead Yet up in Massachusetts. And we're talking about the Aid in Dying legislation. But John, I believe in your state, in Massachusetts, it's also being proposed there?
Yes, there is a bill in committee right now. And, you know, for many years in a row, and the Public Health Committee has listened to our arguments in the past and rejected these bills. And we hope that they will do the same. We just had a court case in Massachusetts in which a Superior Court Judge Mary Kay Ames found that there is no constitutional right to assisted suicide. She listed two main arguments that the legislature might use to oppose the bill. The first was the impossibility of predicting when someone will die. The second is concern about people acting on impulse. For example, J.J. Hansen, who I mentioned before, he went through a period of being very depressed, and if he had had the poison available, he might well have taken it to avoid burdening his family. When he got the support he needed, he was able to live a few more years, have another child, get to know his first child. And again, it's too dangerous. And when proponents keep saying that there's been absolutely no abuse, we beg to differ and point out real cases. So, for example, Wendy Melcher was a trans woman living in Oregon, and two nurses, her hospice nurse and another nurse who was having an affair, allegedly with Wendy's partner, conspired to kill her by putting massive amounts of opioid suppositories in her. When this came to light that they'd acted completely outside the program, the case was dealt secretly by the Oregon Nursing Board. And it's in the Portland Tribune. People could look up Wendy Melcher. And the family did not learn for two more years after Wendy died that her death was pushed along by these two nurses.
Okay, but John, wouldn't you say that would be such an unusual case, that this is out of the norm and this isn't what most people are talking about? Because I want to go back to what you were saying earlier. Because I have been in the position, and many others that I know have been in the position of having loved ones say to us, after all the treatments and everything has been done, and months if not years of medical work and exhausting bank accounts, and you know that the end is near, and they say to you, look, I am in just so much pain at this point. I'm exhausted physically, I'm exhausted mentally, spiritually. I don't want to wake up. I just want this to be over.
Well, I think that person needs to be given the support they deserve. They need to be assured that their pain will be controlled. They can choose a voluntary stopping of eating and drinking, which is a proven treatment that keeps people comfortable. But to institute a suicide program sponsored by the state for people who fear their loss of dignity is just not the way the state should be going, with suicide rates increasing, suicide contagion is real, and to send a message to people living with the same kind of disabilities that are prompting these people to want to die, it ends up the state is sending a terrible message.
John Kelly from Not Dead Yet up in Massachusetts. John, thanks for being with us today. I appreciate your time, and I hope you come back and talk about this in the future.
Would like to. Thanks for having me on again.
Thank you, John. I want to end the program today by bringing back a guest that we've had on before. It's always a pleasure to have him on, the Reverend Anthony Bennett from the Mount Airy Baptist Church in Bridgeport. How are you, Reverend?
Well, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. And as I've always said, when I come back, I want your voice. So let me ask you, Reverend, you've been hearing these arguments, pro and con, for years. As a man of faith, how do you see it?
I see it as a matter of choice. And so I would support legislation that, within responsible means and ways, gives persons the opportunity to die with dignity.
I have to admit, when I heard your position, I guess I was a little caught off guard because, you know, most religious people that I know feel differently. How did you come to this position?
Well, I think, as Jesus would say, in order to save your life, you got to be willing to lose it. In order to lose a life, you end up saving it. It's because I do value life so. That I come to this particular struggle. Certainly, I'm all for things that secure quality of life. But I, as an African American faith person, I also come with the reality of a history of people who understood ending their life. Not always as the worst thing. The enslaved Africans who were caught in the triangular trade, many of them from particular tribes, would make the decision, a very thoughtful decision, that rather than submit themselves, their children, to the atrocities of slavery and enslavement, being fully human, that they would jump overboard and take their chances with the sharks, knowing they would probably not make it back to shore. There again, it is it's that history that helps me take another look to understand sort of the breadth of what it means to have life and dignity. I think it is presumptuous for those who've never been in a particular place. And then ultimately my faith informs me that God gives us choice and free will. And a part of that free will is to make certain decisions about our life and our quality of life. I think the reason also, as a man of faith, is I've sat with countless numbers of family members, including my own, my recent loss of my own daughter. And I have counseled families when the doctors come to them with a sense of, okay, well, are you going to resuscitate? Are you not going to resuscitate? What do you want us to do? And I watch these families wrestle with, well, you know, what should we do, what should we not do, when my faith teaches me that my ultimate life is in the hands of God. My ultimate life is in the hands of God. So therefore, I've seen family members said, well, we're not going to do anything, and that person remains alive. I've seen family members that say, you know, they want to do everything and put that person on ventilators and everything. And it's really the person, is not there. For me, the spirit is what is our life. And as a man of faith, it is that spirit. The body can rust away and deteriorate. And in my own experience, I've experienced people in my family and other places where their spirit is gone. And the body is deteriorated and is being kept alive only by machines. And so because I am a man of faith, the body is not the ultimate residence of who I am.
Reverend, I only have 1 minute left. So if I understand correctly, you think that the aid in dying legislation, if passed, would give those families a choice? Maybe they don't have to utilize it, but it would give them a choice?
It will give them a choice. And certainly for me, I mean, I would do any and everything to keep my family member alive. Yet I also know that because of faith, this is not the end of my journey. And because of faith, I do believe in another life and in the afterlife of heaven. And so, and my scripture, faith, says to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. And so it is because of my faith. So it's almost like we profess and preach that there is a better place, but we live as though, and we try to relegate other people's life as though this is all that there is.
All right. Reverend, I got to hold it there because I'm out of showtime today. Reverend Anthony Bennett, the Mount Airy Baptist Church. Reverend, always a pleasure. Thank you for coming on and sharing with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Reverend Anthony Bennett, the Mount Airy Baptist Church. And just before that, John Kelly from Not Dead Yet. And I also want to thank actor Jim Naughton, Representative Steinberg, Eve Elliott, and Corinne Carey. An excellent discussion today, and I want to thank everyone who came on. If you would like to join the conversation, you could email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org, and on Facebook, you can comment at Full Story WSHU. That's going to do it for our show today. Sabrina Garone is our engineer. Carrie Frank is our digital editor. Associate producers are Fatou Sangari, Sabrina Garone, Roberto Rojas, Desiree DiOrio. J.D. Allen is our producer, and Terry Sheridan is the news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of the Full Story.